Welcome back to Midpoint, friends. On February 4th, 2026, I'm your host, Shelley Reback. I must apologize in advance if you hear a lot of sneezing, wheezing, snuffling, and coughing on today's show. The creeping crud has got me, and it's awful, but the show must go on. Unfortunately, the studio no longer has a mute button on my side of the soundboard, so if you hear me sneezing or coughing, at least you'll know it's not static on your radio. I'm really excited to bring you today's program with my guests, Lisa B. McLean, the elected public defender for the 13th Judicial Circuit, which includes Hillsborough County, and Dion Jones, the chief strategy officer for the PD's office. They are here to tell us about their very innovative new outreach program they call Street Legal, which is taking off at the University Community Resource Center from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on February 21st. Street Legal will be bringing the public defender and a bunch of other social services agencies directly into underserved neighborhoods. Lisa and Dee will be with us in just a few minutes after we review some news nuggets from the past week. All right, you may remember that back in December, Pam Bondi tasked the FBI with compiling a list of domestic terrorist organizations. She based this on a presidential memorandum that said, quote, common threads animating this violent conduct include anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity, support for the overthrow of the United States government, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and hostility toward those who hold traditional American views on family, religion, and morality, close quote. That came out of the Trump regime, and shortly thereafter, the DeSantis regime followed suit. Remember back on January 7th, we did a show with CAIR, that's C-A-I-R, CAIR, the Muslim Civil Rights Organization. That's when we first learned that Governor DeSantis had issued an executive order declaring, without any evidence or legal authority, that CAIR was a domestic terrorist organization and anyone associated with them could not avail themselves of state services. We talked about whether that was meant to apply to CAIR's donors who maybe had state jobs or Muslim schools that received state voucher funds or what, all kinds of things that may have been impacted by such an order if it had any legal effect. But it didn't as an executive order. But it does now, because now DeSantis and the Republican-controlled legislature wants to make sure that this order has the force of law. The bills now moving through the legislature, which are SB 1632 and SB 1634, would give the state sweeping power to label organizations as domestic terrorist organizations, presumably even if they weren't so labeled by the federal government. These bills provide limited transparency and severe penalties, including criminalizing associations. While they are framed broadly, these bills will disproportionately impact Muslim organizations and Palestinian advocacy today, but they certainly create a chilling precedent for all nonprofits and advocacy groups in Florida that the DeSantis regime doesn't like. The companion House bills have already been moved through their committee, and just yesterday, the Senate bills passed in the Senate Judiciary Committee. There's still time to stop these McCarthy-style bills from becoming law. Today, it's directed at Muslims. Tomorrow, it may be ACLU members or even WMNF volunteers. So listen, with my background, I'm going to need one of y'all to water my plants when they haul me off to the gulag. Don't laugh. That seems to be where we are all headed. All right, next. The following few days are going to be critical in stopping HB 1119 and HB 31 from moving forward. Both of these bills have the potential to drastically increase viewpoint-based censorship in our schools and school libraries. state officials would have the power to judge a literary work in its entirety, while locally elected public school leaders, educators, and parents would no longer have that authority. This would change more than 30 years of Florida precedent on how we determine protected speech for minors in public schools. Big surprise, school voucher recipients would not be impacted by this. No censorship for them. And under these bills, the Florida Department of Education would have the power to withhold funding when our communities disagree with state calls for censorship. And it is not just limited to library books in schools. As an example, the bill prohibits using the term West Bank and mandates using the term Judea and Samaria to describe the land west of the Jordan River in all instructional and library materials. This risks viewpoint censoring of global ideas and favors only those ideas that the state is willing to accept. In fact, the bill also requires that that land be referred to as, quote, liberated from Jordan, as opposed to, quote, taken from Jordan. Regardless of your viewpoint on the land, if you truly care about parental rights in the schools, this type of viewpoint censorship is really something you should care about. And next, Florida Decides Healthcare, the organization that was seeking to place a constitutional amendment to expand Medicaid in Florida on the 2026 ballot, did not get enough signatures in time to proceed. The organization announced on Sunday that it will relaunch its campaign to place Medicaid expansion on the ballot in 2028 in an effort to secure healthcare access for millions of Floridians. According to a press release, the group said it will begin collecting new signatures February 1st for the 2028 ballot. This restart follows months of disruption caused by last year's HB 1205, a law that imposed many new barriers on citizen-led ballot initiatives. As the nationwide healthcare crisis continues, cuts to Affordable Care Act subsidies have already pushed thousands of Floridians off their health coverage. Many are seeing their premiums double or triple. Florida Decides Healthcare reports that one in five Florida residents could be uninsured within the next year. Florida Decides Healthcare urges Florida voters to request a new petition by mail to participate in the 2028 election. To request one of those petitions, go to floridadecideshealthcare.org. That's all one word, floridadecideshealthcare.org. All right, interestingly, the Florida Secretary of State, Cord Byrd, also announced this week that the recreational marijuana amendment failed to meet the signature requirements to qualify for the 2026 ballot. But Smart and Safe Florida, the petition group pushing to get adult recreational marijuana on Florida's 2026 November statewide ballot, is saying that the state's announcement of its failure to gather enough signatures is, quote, premature. Smart and Safe Florida said, quote, "We believe the declaration by the Secretary of State is premature, as the final and complete county-by-county totals for validated petitions are not yet reported." They said, "We submitted over 1.4 million signatures and believe when they are all counted, we will have more than enough to make the ballot." Well, I guess we'll see. Remember, the special election for State Senate District 14 in Hillsborough is scheduled for Tuesday, March 24th. Brian Nathan, a union electrician, is the Democrat running against Josie Tomcow, allegedly a multimillionaire Polk County resident. The deedline to register for vote in this special election is February 23rd. But registering to vote is going to be more difficult than ever if the Federal SAVE Act passes in the U.S. Congress. The SAVE Act would require all American citizens to show documents like a passport or their birth certificate to register to vote. A driver's license would not suffice. The Brennan Center research shows that more than 21 million Americans lack ready access to those documents. Roughly half of Americans don't even have a passport. Millions lack access to a paper copy of their birth certificate. The SAVE Act would disenfranchise Americans of all ages and all races, but younger voters and voters of color would suffer more. And millions of women whose married names aren't on their birth certificates or passports would face extra steps just to vote and make their voices heard. So if you took a married name or dropped a married name after a divorce but didn't change your passport name, better rush to do that now to register to vote. And for that, you'll need even more documentation like a marriage record, divorce papers, name change orders, etc. You'll need them all. In fact, if you can afford it, get all your documents in order and get a passport in your current legal name if you don't already have one. You get the idea, don't you? This really isn't about stopping non-citizens who are ineligible to vote. We already do that. This is about stopping voters, particularly women voters, period. All right, let's get to the topic of the day, street legal. Again, I want to introduce my guests, Lisa B. McLean, the elected public defender of Hillsborough County, who has hit the ground running with this very innovative program she's going to tell us about. So welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Shelley. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
All right. And Dion Jones, Chief Strategy Officer of the Public Defender's Office, is also with us to talk about that program and about some of the bills pending in the Florida legislature that could impact the work of the Public Defender's Office. And I'm happy to welcome you too, Dee.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for having us today. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. All right. Let's talk about this program, Street Legal. Who wants to start? Where did this idea come from? Has it been tried elsewhere in the country? What is it?
So I'll jump in here, Shelley. This is a program that came to my mind during the course of my campaigning for this position as public defender, because I had heard some work that was being done by the public defender in the Sixth Circuit, which is Pinellas and Pasco. Bob Dillinger, who's no longer the public defender, but
he passed away.
He did. Yeah. He did shortly after his retirement.
Yeah.
But he was a trailblazer when it came to the idea of reaching out to the community. He, in fact, had a specially fitted bus that he would take into communities where he was primarily focused on juveniles. That was where his heart was. So he took this bus into communities and would do things like ensure that people had appointments for medical care and dental services, and he would have clothing that he would be able to pass out, and he would, you know, coordinate food pantries and those sorts of things. And I just thought that was the greatest idea ever. It's not anything that was ever done in Hillsborough County. It's not something that's continuing to be done in the Sixth Circuit. In fact, that bus was parked on Florida Avenue right by my house for quite some time, and it ultimately sold to someone else. But, I thought that was fabulous. And this idea for Street Legal kind of was that idea of, can we have a mobile unit, which a lot of the other agencies in the state of Florida are actually doing. But we found that to be cost prohibitive. And we're all about being fiscally responsible, and we want to do the most for the least amount of money. And so we decided to pivot on that issue. And we're speaking with people at the county about, locations where we might be able to do this. We started with, the idea was, where are the neighborhoods that are most often served by the public defender? So we gathered up the top three zip codes where our clients live, and the university area was one of them. We toured spaces in all of those zip codes and ultimately chose the university area because they had the best facilities that would lend themselves to what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay, so, and what the facility is, the University Community Resource Center.
Yeah.
On
22nd.
On 22nd Avenue?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as I understand it, it's not just the public defender's office that's going to be participating in this program, but there are a number of other agencies that you've, I don't know whether you've recruited them or they were already there, but a number of other agencies that are going to be available during the street legal hours that you can refer people to for various different problems, right? Like, who are some of those agencies that you've recruited to participate in the program?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are recruiters. I mean, it's something that we talk about all the time. Collaboration is a big deal for us. We do it across the board, not only within our office, but also outside the office with other agencies. And so we started working our connections and meeting with other agencies that we thought made sense. Because, as you know, the Public Defender's Office has a very strong, holistic philosophy when it comes to how we should be representing our clients. So these types of services that will be provided during our street legal sessions are really already being provided to our clients in the courtrooms. But, you know, again, this program is about many things, but one of which is better access and equal access. And so we met with the Tampa Hillsborough Housing Initiative, Ibis Healthcare, which was formerly Grace Point and Cove, which
offers mental health
and
services
and addiction,
right?
Exactly.
And addiction, right?
Yep. Tampa Family Health, which is exactly what it sounds like. They offer
affordable medical services.
Absolutely.
Dental.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand Bay Area Legal Services,
yep,
which offers legal help for civil matters like evictions and divorces.
Exactly.
Will also participate.
Exactly. We fully expect that people will walk in that have many other issues that are outside the parameters of what the Public Defender's Office does, and we didn't want anyone to be left out. We want to be able to address all these issues when people come by to see what we're all about.
And, you know, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office and the Florida Department of Corrections are also going to be present to answer questions about jail or probation.
Absolutely.
To me, one of the major agencies or entities that I would hope would be available to people is the probation office, because, you know, oftentimes clients have trouble getting down for their appointments,
yep,
getting down to the probation offices, getting, you know, testing, whether it's drug testing applying for early termination of probation. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, people often don't have the opportunity to address unless they're actually in the courtroom when they're, like, compelled to be there on a particular occasion. So are we going to have, like, probation there too?
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? The Department of Corrections actually is in the process of retrofitting a mobile unit that they will be taking out into communities. That is something that they worked on for over 3 years because of funding roadblocks. They finally are doing the practical part of getting that bus ready. That's being done in a couple of other jurisdictions in the state of Florida very successfully. I don't remember the exact number, but I want to say the reduction in technical violations, like what you were just talking about, is somewhere between 20% and 30% reduced when they can get out into the community. So we're not inventing the wheel here as far as trying to get closer to the people that we're trying to help. We're just doing it in a different way.
Yeah, but you know, those technical violations pile up and they cost so much money for
Absolutely.
The defendants, for the clients. And, you know, it's just another way to criminalize poverty if people can't afford to pay for their anger management class or their drug testing or whatever, you know? So I find that in particular to be really something that would be very, very useful. So they'll be at street legal too, probation.
They will.
Yeah. Okay. So let's imagine how it will actually work. I know this is going to be the first time you're holding the event, so it's hard to play out exactly, but let's project. Let's say Joe shows up with a multitude of problems on Saturday the 21st. Maybe he's got a failure to appear. He's got no health care. Maybe he failed to appear because he got no health care and he was sick, and he wants a divorce. What can street legal do and not do for him? Or what do you expect that you can do for somebody like Joe with those kinds of problems?
So I'm going to defer to Dion here in a second, but let me just say that we have spent an extraordinary amount of time trying to envision every possible scenario. And the starting point when people come to this location will be an intake form, so that we will have and our office will be controlling that part of things. The intake form will talk about all of those kinds of issues so that we can then steer people in the direction they need to go. We will handle all of their inquiries ethically, the way that we would do if they were coming to our office. I mean, it's really no different than if someone were to set an office appointment with their lawyer.
Well, let me stop you before we get into the specifics about Joe's problems. Joe may already be a client of your office.
Yeah.
So the advice that you give him, you know, is something that presumably you would do if he came downtown to your office. But if somebody isn't already a client of the public defender's office, but they have issues or they have questions, can they speak to your lawyers there?
Absolutely. And we're not only going to have our lawyers there, we will also have employees of the office that do social service mitigation, that do investigation, that are there to assist in any way they can. Because, again, our office, because of the holistic nature of what we do, we have all those folks on staff. And every single part of our agency, every kind of group that we have, will be there to offer that assistance, the same as it would be whether they're a client or not.
Okay.
We continue, not only do we do that now when people call our office in trying to set up referrals and other things like that, but we do it when we represent them, after we represent them, because we're trying to address the underlying causes of crime. You know,
right.
How do people end up in the criminal justice system to begin with? And you and I have been doing this long enough that we know what those issues are. And that's why we chose the partners that we chose to be involved, because it's been our experience that these kinds of things, homelessness, childhood trauma, addiction, mental health, these are the things that are the underlying concerns of our clients.
All right. So, Dee, give me an idea. Give me an idea about when Joe shows up with his problems, how will it work? You know, he's got a failure to appear, maybe because he's got health issues, he's got no health care, and he wants a divorce. So how would somebody like Joe, you know, get addressed?
I think Lisa, you know, hit the nail on the head when she said specifically the questionnaire is going to help us direct, right? So first of all, we also need to ask, do you have a private attorney? Because if he has a private attorney, that's a different conversation that we would have with Joe on that day versus he has no attorney at all, pro bono, or we represent him. Bay Area Legal Services will be there. So with specifically addressing his divorce case, they would probably have a consultation with him. And then decide if on the spot they can qualify him for their services or not. If they can, then we have private rooms in the back where they can go in the back and have a consultation with Joe and kind of work through what that divorce, you know, scenario might look like, whether that's on the spot helping him file a petition or get an injunction or whatever, you know, is needed in that realm. Or it may be, you know, we're going to have to process some paperwork for you, set an appointment, follow up later. So the partners that are there can do on-the-spot referrals, they can do on-the-spot consultations, but there are scenarios, because we don't know every scenario of every person that walks through the door, where they may have to have a follow-up appointment with that particular agency.
So, you know, the one that really strikes me as potentially problematical is Joe's failure to appear. Like, the sheriff's department's going to be there. As his attorney, presumably, you know, have an ethical obligation not to blow him in, I think, and not to turn him over to the sheriff, but the sheriff's going to be there. So what would happen to somebody like Joe in that situation?
So, again, our intake process, I think, would control that to some extent. You know, in that scenario, we have an ethical obligation to tell Joe that he needs to turn himself in,
right,
or that we need to see about setting him a new court date, depending on the nature of the failure to appear. Those are all the things that we would be doing, ethically doing, if that person were coming into our office. So no, we're not going to be steering Joe to go see the guy from the sheriff's office,
right,
who's sitting there with, you know, 16 pairs of handcuffs on
right.
the table. I mean, that's not,
no.
You know, primarily, frankly, the sheriff's office is there to make sure that things go smoothly.
Right.
Where it's going to be a community resource deputy that is very entrenched in that community already, very well known, non-threatening. I mean, we obviously don't expect anyone to leave Street Legal in handcuffs
right.
on a Saturday.
That's
not the intention, and all the agencies appreciate why they're there and how they should be conducting themselves.
All right. Well, that's good. All right. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF, and I'm Shelley Reback here with Public Defender of Hillsborough County, Lisa B. McLean, and Chief Strategy Officer Dion Jones. And we're talking about Street Legal, taking the PD's office to the people and the neighborhoods around the county where their clients are. Their first event is going to be Saturday, February 21st from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the University Community Resource Center. Let me take a call here from a very patient listener, David in Bushnell. You're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Shelley.
Hi.
Hey, Shelley.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Brian.
I can't, take yourself off speakerphone. We can't hear you.
Oh, you can't hear me? I'm in the car right now.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, but all I hear is wind.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, this is David Bryant from Soul Kitchen.
Okay, David. You have a question for our guests?
Yeah, I just wanted to say this sounds like the bookmobile concept, and I love it. And I was wondering if these folks could help people, former felons, restore their voting rights.
Get an expungement, you mean? Yeah. All right, well, let me ask them. Thank you for your patience, David, holding on.
Thanks.
All right, well, we'll ask them. Yeah, what about expungements, you know?
That's one of the reasons why Bay Area Legal Services is there, because that is a service that they already are providing to the community. We have been engaged in other sort of organized Saturdays where that's been the goal. The Hillsborough County Bar Association does that in conjunction with a lot of other agencies.
Volunteer
right.
lawyers.
And we participate in that as far as like making sure that people qualify, but that is actually outside the parameters of Chapter 27, which kind of tells us what we can and cannot do. Because it's a
post-conviction.
Exactly.
Thing,
and while we do post-conviction that is
criminal
and proceeding through the system, we are not able to handle things like motions for early term or expungement. We do have ways that we guide people on motions for early term that they're able to do pro se. In other words,
you're talking about early termination
of like
probation.
I should have been clearer on that. But no, we actually, when Dion and I met with the folks from Bay Area, and by the way, can I just say that, you know, I know that we've said that we were recruiters here, but the amount of time that it would take in a conversation with one of these agencies, once we explained what we were doing, you know, the hands went flying up with how can I help? You know, this was never a difficult decision for anyone that we met with. And when we talked to Bay Area about the things that we thought might come up, whether it was custody issues, other family law type stuff, expungements, sealings, evictions, you know, the types of things that we expected to potentially see with the groups that we expect to be able to walk to where we are. That's another thing that we didn't really talk about. I mean, this is a highly walkable area. And so when we talk about equal access, that was another reason why we chose this particular location, because we want people to be able to walk up, bike up. I mean, if they can drive, great. But if they have those kinds of impediments to access to our people and these other agencies, we wanted to be in a space where they could just walk right in.
Yeah, because lack of public transportation in Hillsborough County is one of the things that really is detrimental to people being able to, you know, conduct the affairs of their life, whether it's getting to court on time on the day they need to be there when they're compelled to be there, or getting to medical appointments or what have you, getting to down to Bay Area Legal Services. The fact that we have no good public transportation infrastructure is a real problem for Hillsborough County. It's a problem for business growth, and it's a problem for all of these types of it's a predicate to all of these types of problems that we've been discussing could hopefully be addressed at this program on Saturday the 21st.
And Shelley, just to add on to Lisa's comment with respect to the expungement and the sealing of, you know, prior convictions, that's one component. Your caller may be also asking, okay, now that's been done, how do I actually go about petitioning to get my rights restored, right? And so while we can't do that within our office, there are several agencies within Hillsborough County that will help with that. The George Edgecombe Bar Association, the president is Shamir Ellis. I don't have her contact information readily available, but I know the George Edgecombe Bar Association does a legal clinic in the spring where they will help restoration of rights. There's also Florida Rising, Robin Lockett. You're very familiar with Robin. I know she's done some work around that as well. And I think it's called Equality Florida that's also done work around restoration of convicted felon rights. So the first step, yes, is the expungement piece, but there's also, okay, now that I've done all that, how do I get all these fees wiped off off the book that I you know, the state says I have to pay, and then actually apply to get, you know, their voting rights restored.
Right. So who does that? Like, if somebody's on probation and they've racked up all these fees, but they, you know, they don't really have substantive violations and they should be a good candidate for early termination, but for the fact that they're sitting with all this debt to the state, what would you advise that person to do?
Well, you know, very often in those situations, especially when a person is on probation, if a person comes in, believe it or not, on a violation, say for technicals like we've been talking about, whether it's a dirty urine or you're behind in money or you're behind in community service hours, Hillsborough County has really been pretty cutting edge with how they've handled those types of violations over the years. I mean, it's been a little while now. I mean, I've been doing this for so long, it feels like it was yesterday. But,
yeah, but I haven't, so I'm not familiar with how it's changed in the past. You know, when I was still practicing, it was huge, huge problem.
Yeah. Well, we have a dedicated violation or probation division, which primarily, you know, gives people the opportunity to move into the system quicker than they did in the past. There were many times before the implementation of that division that people would be sitting in jail for weeks before they would ever even get a court date in front of the judge that put them on probation. And so the way that that was dealt with was to bring this violation or VOP division to Hillsborough County, where people are typically getting in to see a judge within a week, if not quicker, from the time that they're arrested, because, you know, them losing their job when they're not already behind
in their fees,
doesn't make any sense. And we've had historically judges in that division that have a good grasp on those kinds of practical considerations and are doing what they can. And we have three lawyers assigned to that division, which is a pretty high number because it's pretty labor-intensive work trying to get people to a place where they can, if they don't have a job, to get a job, to ask the court to waive those kinds of fees, which the court can do. And so many times people may come in on a technical violation, and rather than go to prison, their probation's actually being terminated because there's a recognition that, hey, this is not really willful. Like, I've got a lot of issues going on. There's a lot of stuff going on. And does it really make any sense for DOC to be supervising me and, you know, the courts to be dealing with this kind of technical violation? Let's get you off of probation, and then our office will follow up with the things that we can do to make your life better. So that has changed dramatically over the years.
I'm so glad to hear that. All right, you're listening to WMNF. This is Midpoint. I'm Shelley Rebeck, and we're here with Lisa McLean and Dion Jones from the Hillsborough County Public Defender's Office talking about their new program, Street Legal, which is going to be kicking off on February 21st, Saturday, at the University Community Resource Center from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. If you have a question for Lisa or Dion, give us a call at 813-239-9663. Send us an email to dj@wmnf.org or even a text at 813-433-0885. So I know this is your first one that's coming up on the 21st, so it's, you know, it's hard to, I imagine, predict a lot about what's going to happen. But do you anticipate that the same lawyers will be assigned to this program month after month? Because this is going to be like a once-a-month thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be the third Saturday of the month. Is
third
that the
Saturday
current plan?
Every month, yes. And to answer, you know, I'll start out answering your question, Shelley.
Yeah,
because
please.
One of the things that Lisa has been very intentional about is making sure that the public understands what we do and the amount of experience that we have in this office. And I think she sat down one day, you know, casually and just thought, wow, between my homicide division and my felony divisions and my chiefs and bureau chiefs, you know, what's the number of years of experience that we have with some of the people on the executive team? And it's over, I think, 150 years of experience, right? So the first time that we do this, we're going to launch with the executive team because we want to make sure that the people that are coming in not only receive the help that they need, but that we can work through some of the kinks before we bring in those that are on the front line that will be servicing our clients on a monthly basis.
So that executive team is the people with the most experience and long, maybe longest tenure in your office.
Absolutely.
Or in the system, the criminal justice system.
Yes, our chief assistant, Kim Hyman, will be there. Our felony bureau chief, Will Knight, will be there. Our misdemeanor juvenile chief, Antina Mobley, will be there. Our chief of investigations, Corey Warren, will be there. I'll be there myself. Of course, Ms. McLean will be there. So every chief that functions in every capacity in our office, for the most part, will be there on the 21st to help launch the initiative. Now, we did ask our line attorneys, which are people that are on the front lines every day servicing our clients, that they follow up and sign up for the remaining months. So in March, we probably have already about 5 or 6 felony attorneys that have signed up. Some support staff as well, because that area also has a high Hispanic population. So we want to make sure that we have a translator there so that we don't have language barriers.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, we'll have language barriers. And then we have also people that just want to come out and help. Because Lisa's motto with the office on every single location, we never say, that doesn't fit me, I can't do that, I don't understand, I don't know. Our motto is, how can I help? So everyone in the office is joining in, they're pitching in, because they really do believe in the mission and what Lisa's trying to accomplish here.
So these are people, are they volunteers for the Saturday program? Or?
Yeah, they are. So we actually had a pep rally on a Friday. Well, it's what we called it a couple of Fridays ago to launch the initiative with the office. Because, well, you know, there'd been some rumblings about things that we were doing, and I mean rumblings in the best possible way. We really wanted them to understand what the focus was and what the mission is and how it fits into what we do on a daily basis. And there was a ton of excitement. We had, you know, probably close to 200 people in the only room in our office that's big enough to even barely hold 200 people, and talked about what we did. We had a sign-up genius QR code so that people could you know, point and click right there on the spot and sign
and
up.
Pick a Saturday.
Right, and we had lots of sign-ups already. We told them that, you know, we wanted to start on February, but that they could start in March. And so, you know, we have, we do a lot of community service at the office. But we do recognize that asking folks to give of a Saturday is a big deal.
Yeah.
So we don't expect, you know, the same people to show up all the time, although that might happen. I mean, it's hard to say.
Well, I assume there's going to be some training.
Absolutely.
Like,
I was about to address that. Absolutely. So we actually had some scheduled, but when we decided that we were going to do the executive team in February, we've pushed that back a couple of weeks. But no, there will absolutely be training, because we want, especially the younger attorneys, to understand, you know, and trust me, there's not going to be inexperienced lawyers there. First of all, I'm going to be there every single time, you know, we're there. And I'm sure that my chief assistant will be there as well. People with 20 to 35 years of experience that are really going to be able to answer any question.
Yeah.
But we also will have our laptops there that, not to get too deep in the woods on our case management system, but it's top notch. And, you know, if a person is in fact already a client, there's going to be a ton of information that's available to that lawyer about what's going on with the case, what the police report says, what the videos look like, you know, what the evidence is.
Things have changed so much since I retired, you know.
Yeah, because we're paperless.
Yeah, you're paperless now. You can bring up a case file, you know, on a computer. And, I mean, you don't have to, like, run to the clerk's office to figure out what the status of the case is. I mean, yeah, it's really great. Let me ask you, will you be moving the program to different sites around the county, or will it always meet at University Community Resource Center?
So for now, we plan to stay where we are for a while and sort of become kind of entrenched in that community. We want people to expect that we're there and that we're going to be there. That's not to say that there won't be a time where we may look at other zip codes or other areas, or that we may tweak the program to an extent where on a particular Saturday that we're focused on this particular issue. For example, if we wanted to have Nancy Milan's office out there to help with driver's licenses.
The tax collector.
Exactly.
Right.
The things that she does, those kinds of things. So before we, you know, drag everybody else in, we want to see how it's going to work for us.
Okay. In addition to that, Shelley, I think one of the things Lisa has also thought about along with the executive team is we want to be able to track and scale strategically, right? And so we want to follow our clients long term. We talked about doing longitudinal studies. I know Sarah Banky, who's our administrative director, she's written grants. I've worked in the academic space as well. So research is a part of my heart, and I want to make sure that if we can apply for a grant to help fund the program, we can do that. Also, we want to really look at what are our data outcomes. Does this program impact recidivism? Because that's what it's about as well. How are we driving down recidivism so that when we go to Tallahassee and we, you know, make our advocacy
pitch
efforts, can say, look, this is the impact that this program is having. Now we want to scale it up and we need your support.
Yeah, that would seem to be really important. Although with our current legislature, I don't know that I don't know how much they care about reducing recidivism as opposed to making people pay, literally making people pay. And that brings me to my next question, which is, can we spend a minute talking about pending legislation? Because at least on this show, I try to keep people informed about what's happening in Tallahassee because it's so difficult to find that out. I'm very interested in the bail reform legislation that's pending. There was for a while a push by progressive prosecutors to try to get rid of cash bail altogether because it was a way of sort of criminalizing poverty. If people could not afford to pay a cash bail, they sat in jail while they're innocent until proven guilty. But now it seems like things are moving in the opposite direction, at least in Florida. HB 1017, House Bill 1017, is now pending in the Florida legislature. And it seems like that is bringing back cash bail, making an arrest even more punitive than it was before, making it more difficult for people to be released pending trial. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So House Bill 1017, like you said, Shelley, is primarily framed as a bail bond reform bill, but it really does contain significant substantive changes to Florida's pretrial release framework. It significantly alters how courts must respond to failures to appear. Under the bill, a defendant who fails to appear and then later voluntarily surrenders is rendered ineligible for release on recognizance.
So regardless of the reasons they failed to appear, they're not getting out. Correct.
If the defendant is arrested after a failure to appear, the court is prohibited really from granting recognizance release and must impose a monetary bond of at least $2,000 or twice the original bond amount, whichever is greater.
So now that was not the case before, right, Lisa? I mean, before judges had discretion. What happened? Why didn't you appear?
Yeah.
And they had some discretion to release the person depending on the circumstances, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, as an attorney, when someone comes to you and says, hey, I've missed a court date, the first thing you're discussing with them is we need to arrange for you to surrender. And sometimes some judges in Hillsborough County will allow you to surrender in their courtroom.
Right.
Others will require that you surrender to the jail, but there's the ability to coordinate. Okay, well, if you're going to go to the jail on this day, we're going to have your court date on the very next day. Because again, we're trying to keep people working, keep them employed,
right,
keep them, you know, being able to care for their children and all of those kinds of issues. And historically in Hillsborough County, turning yourself in is a big deal. You know,
yeah,
judges recognize that you come there, that you are accepting responsibility for the behavior. You're offering an explanation, not an excuse, but an explanation as to why this occurred. And depending on what the explanation is, it was very often the case that either the original bond would be reinstated or a person would be ROR'd. And so here, you know, you're talking about this idea.
That's release on recognizance.
Just, right, exactly. Yeah. Which is just crazy to me because aside from the constitutional idea of the presumption of innocence, you're also absolutely financially punishing people for activity sometimes over which they have very little control.
Right.
And it's not about, you know, really, you know, there have been many times where I've said to judges, in a kind and respectful way. Let's keep our eye on the ball here. I mean, the purpose of bail is to ensure that a person appears for court. It's not to punish them
right.
for a crime.
They haven't
for
been
which they have not been
yet.
Convicted.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, and let's also talk about the fact that it's going to put a huge burden on the taxpayers of Hillsborough County to have all these people who might otherwise have been eligible for release now being warehoused in the county jail until their case is resolved, right?
Yeah, and the $2,000, Shelley, really is even more on the lower level offenses. On felony enhanced cases, it's a $10,000, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're talking about people, as Lisa and you were saying, that already have challenges financially, and now you're going to tack on this $10,000 bond. And we mentioned earlier, you know, if I'm sick, I have childcare issues, I have housing issues. Those are legitimate reasons why I may not appear, you know, because if holistically I have other circumstances that are dictating my behavior, it's not because I just want to avoid the system or I want to rebuke the system, but there are other challenges that are prohibiting me from complying, and those can be rectified.
Yeah, and let's remind everybody that the Public Defender's Office, all of your clients are indigent. That's
right.
Why you exist.
Right.
It's not like they have $10,000 or even $2,000 to spare, or their families do. If they're your client, it's because they are poor, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. I mean, our representation is based on the federal poverty level. Our representation is if you are making more than 200% more than the federal poverty level, which at this point the guidelines are that a single person is considered to be impoverished if they make $15,000 or less.
A year. Wow.
I can't even imagine how a person lives on $15,000. So for us, it would be, so if you do 200% of that, it's, if you make more than, if you're a single person and you make more than 30 grand, essentially, you don't qualify for the services of the public defender. If you're a family, it's closer to twice that much. But yeah, that's the first determination. It's made by both the clerk and the court as to whether or not we're going to even be representing that individual.
Yeah. So these new bail reform proposals would significantly impact your clients.
Yes.
I mean, really, seriously. And again, if you're a taxpayer in Hillsborough County, I can't believe that this is that not giving judges discretion to let out from custody someone who is appropriately let out. I mean, I can't believe that's you would want that as a taxpayer.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, all right. I think that there's a couple other questions I just wanted to ask you since I have you here. Just quickly, have you seen any effect in Hillsborough County on the Trump administration's immigration surge? Has that affected your office at all? The courthouse, the jail, do any undocumented clients, for example, get bail now, or does every single one of them have a detainer slapped on them immediately a federal detainer where they can't be released by a state court judge? Because I know in the past, there was like a lag time where a state court judge could make a determination that this person might be eligible for a bond before the feds came in. And I know you have to warn clients of the immigration consequences if they're convicted of crimes when you are resolving their case. But are clients more likely to want to fight even their misdemeanor cases now because they know it will more likely lead to deportation or not?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there in that series of questions. So let me start with, yes, there has been a change in the speed at which a hold is placed on one of our clients. It's pretty immediate. So before they even come to their first appearance, which the law requires that they appear in front of a judge within 24 hours of their arrest, there's already a hold that's notated on the docket. So the judge is already aware that in this instance, he, Logan Murphy, has no discretion to set a bond, or can set a bond, but it isn't going to matter because
oh, yeah.
they have an immigration hold and they're not going anywhere. Then as to the issue of whether or not a person is more inclined to try their case. That is the case, absolutely, because we are, while we do a lot of training around this issue, in fact, we just had a training, I think, on Monday that I was able to sit through part of that, because we have some very passionate lawyers in our office about this issue. Yeah, they're more inclined to try the case.
Yeah, they're
no
more
question.
Inclined to try the case because if they have even a misdemeanor conviction, they're gone, you know?
Right.
Maybe to Texas or elsewhere.
Yeah, you know? And it's hard to offer advice now because we just, you know, the law is kind of ever changing and frankly, sometimes kind of being ignored.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a difficult space for us.
Yeah. All right. Well, I just really appreciate you guys coming in here and telling us about this street legal program because I think it's just very exciting. As someone who, you know, once spent time in the criminal justice system, I'm really excited to learn more as it goes on about how this can help, you know, people stay out of trouble, really, is what it's all about. So I'm grateful that you've been here today. That's pretty much all the time we have today, my friends. So thank you to Lisa B. McLean, the elected public defender of Hillsborough County, and Dion Jones, our chief strategy officer from the 13th Judicial Circuit. We wish them the very best with their new program, Street Legal, that is bringing the PD's office out into the community to meet their clients where they are. The first Street Legal event, again, will take place on Saturday, February 21st from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the University Community Resource Center, 13605 North 22nd Street in Tampa. So if you need some advice from the PD's office or from a number of these other partner agencies, you should show up there on Saturday the 21st. Thanks also to our operations volunteers, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling, for their help with the show. And I want to remind you that our fundraising drive is coming up in 2 weeks. And we would be very grateful if you were able and willing to support the Midpoint Show by going to the website and putting in Midpoint, directing your contribution to Midpoint or MPW in the drop-down menu. We have some terrific WMNF swag to say thank you for your support, and you can see all of it on the website. I'd love to thank you personally or anonymously, if you prefer, on air on our fundraising show on February 18th. Now stay tuned for Talking Animals right after the NPR News. We are WMNF Tampa.
Support for WMNF comes from listeners like you and Indivisible Pinellas, presenting Run for Something, an event focused on civic engagement and community participation. Run for Something takes place Saturday, February 21st at 3:30 p.m. More information is available at indivisiblemidpinellas.org.
Support for WMNF comes from listeners like you and TEDx University of South Florida, featuring Held Together, an independently organized TED event exploring resilience, storytelling, and community, happening March 7th from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at USF's Oval Theater. More information is available at TEDxUniversityofSouthFlorida.com.
Through the wasting, there's no guarantee. WMNF, Tampa.